Welcome back once again to Middle Earth, and this time for the last time. And I can say in the words of Mr. Frodo on the slopes of Mount Doom, I'm glad you're all here with me, here at the end of all things. At any rate, tonight we plunge into the last of our seven sacraments, the Sacrament of Holy Orders. And as Ernestine pointed out, this is a very apt time for us to be talking about Holy Orders because Saturday morning, our very own Chris Maslow will be ordained to the transitional diaconate. So as we kind of move through this teaching tonight, keep him in mind, keep him in your prayers in the days ahead. And, of course, he'll be here at Mount Carmel on Sunday morning to be a deacon for us. It's going to be awesome. So Sacrament of Holy Orders. I will confess from the start that I'll be focusing primarily on the priesthood. So, of course, the diaconate is part of holy orders. Bishops, that's part of holy orders. But I'm going to be focusing more on priesthood because, well, that's what I'm discerning, and that's what I've been thinking a lot about. In fact, I'd really like to give credit to the Lord of the Rings for, in many ways, preparing the ground for my vocation. What better way to prepare for a life of sacrifice and grace than Tolkien's sweeping vision of just beauty, of energy, of self-denial, of sacrifice, all of these things, this beautiful story. And in light of this, I'd like to begin our discussion of the Sacrament of Holy Orders by talking about two vocation stories that you find in the Lord of the Rings. So the first vocation story, the first story of a calling to something that you could compare to the priesthood, is taken from the beginning of The Hobbit. So the book famously kicks off with those lines, in a hole in the ground there lived a hobbit, not a nasty, dirty, wet hole filled with the ends of worms and oozy smell, nor yet a dry, bare, sandy hole with nothing in it to sit down on or to eat. It was a hobbit hole, and that means comfort. Really, everything started with that line for Tolkien, in a hole in the ground there lived a hobbit. He had no idea what that would lead to. I think he scribbled it on the side of a paper that he was grading. But at any rate, it kickstarted this story about a hobbit named Bilbo Baggins. And it says that the hole that he lived in was comfortable. The hole that he lived in was very comfortable. And isn't that where we like to be? In a comfortable hole in the ground, minding our own business, going about our daily lives. But that is precisely where the Lord comes right in and messes everything up. He messes up our best laid plans. What is the saying that if you want to make God laugh, tell him your plans? Bilbo Baggins understands this very, very well. If you ask priests or seminarians what they were doing before they decided to go to seminary, a lot of them will say something along the lines of, well, I was just minding my own business. I was an ordinary young man. I was dating girls, I was working, I was out having fun, I was living a normal life, enjoying a fairly comfortable life, until, and everything hinges upon that until, that mysterious until that tells so much about what God was doing in that person's life, oftentimes without them even realizing it. So Bilbo's great until moment came one fateful morning in the Shire. And all he wanted to do was sit down, smoke a pipe, maybe read the paper, and enjoy a quiet morning. Just an ordinary, mundane moment, right? The kind of moment that Bilbo probably enjoyed hundreds of times before. But this morning was different. This morning, something new happened. Gandalf the Wizard shows up. Gandalf the Wizard shows up on his doorstep, and Bilbo welcomes him kind of nervously. He says, good morning. And the wizard responds kind of curiously, what do you mean? Do you wish me a good morning, or mean that it is a good morning whether I want it or not? Or that you feel good this morning? Or that it is a morning to be good on? And Bilbo has no idea what he has going on, what this crazy person is talking about. So he says, all of them at once, and a very fine morning for a pipe of tobacco. Already we can sense that Bilbo realizes that this morning is not going the way that he planned. So Gandalf, with eyebrows raised and his eyes filling with that mysterious light, then says these words that will forever change Bilbo's life. He says, I am looking for someone to share in an adventure I am arranging. And it's very difficult to find anyone. It's very difficult to find anyone. Those are the words of Gandalf. You can almost hear Christ's lament. The harvest is plentiful, but the laborers are few. So pray, therefore. Pray that the Lord of the harvest sends out laborers into his harvest. Whether Bilbo realized it or not, he was being chosen in this moment. He was being called. He was being given his vocation. But Bilbo responds to Gandalf's search for an adventurer with scorn. He says, so when Gandalf says it's really hard to find anybody, Bilbo responds, "I should think so. In these parts, we are plain quiet folk and have no use for adventures. Nasty, disturbing, uncomfortable things. Make you late for dinner," which is very important for hobbits. Dinner is very important for hobbits. So after an awkward pause of just Gandalf and Bilbo standing there, Bilbo pipes in once again. "Good morning." Bilbo is deflecting the call, right? He's kind of like setting up a wall. He distances himself from Gandalf. He refuses to take the wizard's words as something personal. He refuses to take Gandalf's words as personal. He tries to make them more general. You know, instead of saying, "Well, I'm not called to be on an adventure," he says, "Well, nobody around here wants adventures." He wants to speak in generalizations. While Gandalf's election, his choice of Bilbo, is personal. He knows Bilbo. He knows that this is good for him. So Bilbo's good mornings are an attempt to push Gandalf away. And I think if you ask any priest or seminarian, they'll be pretty honest with you that their original response to God's call was good morning. God, when we first hear that call, we want to push God away. We want to push him away very far, because this is something that we weren't expecting. We just wanted to smoke our pipe and enjoy the morning paper. But God comes in and tries to do something new. We all tend to do this. We all tend to shuffle the Lord out of the way so that we can get back to our comfortable morning. Pope Benedict XVI points out, however, and this is one of the most beautiful quotes that I think he has. He says, "The world promises you comfort, but you are not made for comfort. You are made for greatness." And that's what Gandalf is trying to communicate to Bilbo. You're not made for comfort, Bilbo. You're made for greatness. And I have this great adventure for you. And this goes for more than just a call to a religious vocation, to the priesthood. We all tend to good morning, the amazing invitation to embark on an adventure with God. For that's precisely what any vocation ultimately is. It's an adventure. To respond to God's call, especially to the priesthood, is to respond to an invitation not so different from Gandalf's. "I'm looking for someone to share in an adventure." Priests have an incredible share in God's great mission to sanctify the world. Priests share intimately in the quest for souls, the adventure of preaching the gospel to all peoples and nations. And yet so many young men, so many, when they hear the Lord's call, respond a lot like Bilbo. Adventures are nasty, disturbing, uncomfortable things. They make you late for dinner. Good morning. Gandalf replies, "What a lot of things you do use good morning for." Gandalf's words are kind of confusing. "Now you mean that you want to get rid of me, and that it won't be good till I move off." Lucky for our friend Bilbo, Gandalf doesn't give up on the stubborn little hobbit. Much like the Lord, his nudging continues, and even Gandalf says to Bilbo's great dismay. Gandalf keeps pushing. And he says, "I will give you what you asked for. In fact, I will go so far as to send you on this adventure." Very amusing for me, very good for you. Which I find to be a very Gandalf line. It's going to be really funny for me. It's going to be great for you. And I think that's kind of the Lord's proposal to us. It's going to be hilarious. God has a sense of humor. Discerning any call is going to have its ups and downs. It's going to be an adventure. It's going to be funny. And it's also going to be for our best good. God knows what's best for us. But Bilbo is still flustered. He says, "Sorry, I don't want any adventures, thank you. Not today. Good morning." With that, Tolkien writes that the hobbit turned and scuttled inside his round green door and shut it as quickly as he dared, not to seem rude. Wizards are, after all, wizards. I think this scene really reveals the experience of so many seminarians. Once we hear that invitation of grace, we want to ignore it. We want to shut our round little green hobbit hole door. But the call doesn't go away so easily. try as we may. The thought keeps intruding, keeps butting in. It's almost like the idea of priesthood invites itself over, unwelcome into our hearts, much like Gandalf ends up inviting 13 annoying, boisterous dwarves over to Bilbo's house the next day when they proceed to eat all of his food and mess up his house and just disrupt everything. And for some people, that's what a call to the priesthood might feel like. 13 annoying, boisterous dwarves inviting themselves over for brunch. It seems to mess up everything. It messes up all our plans. To continue the story, the dwarves that then explain to Bilbo that their intention is to travel to the Lonely Mountain because Smaug the dragon has taken over this mountain, stolen their gold, and kicked them out of their house. So all their gold was lost, and they want Bilbo to come and help them get it back. They want him to be the 14th member of their company, and they want him to be a burglar. And this is not something that Bilbo is comfortable doing. He has no idea what he's getting himself into. But anyways, it seems kind of decided for Bilbo at this point. They're like, yeah, you're coming. It's going to be great. But then there comes the next morning, and everyone is gone already. All the dwarves have left already. There's a note on the mantelpiece saying, you know, meet us at such and such place at 10 o'clock sharp in the morning if you want to come with us. We hope to see you there, basically. And there's this incredible moment when Bilbo has to decide. He has to decide if he wants to go or not. And it's such a really profound moment. I remember when I watched this moment in the Hobbit movie when it first came out. It was around the same time that I was discerning going into seminary. And seeing Bilbo, just you could see the spark in his eye that, like, this is not what I want, but it's also exactly what I want. And I totally related to Bilbo in that moment of this push and pull. I want this, but I also don't want this. And then he just dashes off. He runs out the door. And to the end of his days, Tolkien writes, Bilbo could never remember how he found himself outside without a hat, a walking stick, or any money, or anything that he usually took when he went out, leaving his second breakfast half finished and quite unwashed up, pushing his keys into Gandalf's hands and running as fast as his furry feet could carry him down the lane. Bilbo is filled with joy. He's ready to go. He's ready to leave home, even though he's not ready. And I think in this amazing paragraph, it sums up what going off to seminary felt like for me. You build up all of this nerve, you build up all of this courage to actually go, and you're so filled with excitement and the prospect of adventure that you don't even have time to realize how absurdly unprepared you actually are. You end up dashing off to the adventure of seminary without hat, without walking stick, not even a pocket handkerchief. And I think it's worth saying at this point that nobody is ready to go to seminary. Nobody is ever actually prepared. And the ones that say that they're prepared are the ones that really aren't, are extra unprepared. It's an act that requires a plunge into the unknown, and nobody knows what they've agreed to. Just like Bilbo had no clue the kind of adventure that he was getting himself into. Bilbo's journey has other parallels to seminary formation. For one thing, seminarians need to always remember that seminary isn't the end. You know, you're not going to seminary to stay in seminary, thank God. The Hobbit's subtitle is aptly There and Back Again. And in a similar vein, seminary is a story of there and back again. You go off to seminary, you get formed, you go through a series of adventures, and then you come back again to serve the people of God where you came from, where at your home, right? That's the beauty of the diocesan priesthood, I think, is that you hear the calling within a particular people, within a particular local church, and then you go to seminary and come back to that local church to serve. There and back again, right? All in all, a seminarian comes back to his home diocese totally different, too. So totally transformed, and yet more fully himself than he ever was. So Bilbo, when he comes home, his neighbors don't even recognize him. They think he died. He's been gone for a while. And they don't know what to do. They're like, who is this? And why is he dressed funny? And why is he carrying all this gold? What's going on? He is more himself in that moment than he ever was when he was comfortably secure in his hobbit hole. He became who he was created to be. And that is the mark of a very good vocation story. Our next vocation story is Frodo's vocation story. So you'll remember that Frodo, we talked about the flight to the Ford, right, in terms of baptism. We talked about how Frodo comes to Rivendell and the Ringwraiths are washed away and he has to get healed from his knife wound. Well, when he gets better, Elrond calls a council. It's called the Council of Elrond. And this scene, I think, provides us with a number of key insights into what a call to the priesthood looks like, especially the uniquely Marian quality of a young man's response to the Lord's invitation. But let me first set the stage. So the Council of Elrond was itself a providential meeting. Elrond did not summon all these people that showed up for the Council of Elrond. They all kind of happened to come to Rivendell at the same time. They all kind of found themselves there, and they realized something else is at work. They came on separate errands, but they all came at the perfect time for like these really powerful and important people of Middle-earth to make a decision about what was to be done about Sauron, about this great threat of Mordor. So there in the midst of all these pivotal players from across Middle-earth, Gandalf recounts start to finish the story of the ring, as it was known up until that point, how it was taken from the hand of Sauron by Isildur, Aragorn's ancient ancestor, how it betrayed Isildur and was lost and was found by the creature Gollum, and then how it was picked up by the most unlikely person imaginable, our friend Bilbo Baggins, on that adventure that he agreed to go to that we just talked about. And then it finally came to Frodo, Bilbo's only heir, his adopted heir. And there comes a moment during the Council of Elrond when it becomes clear that the only choice that they have as a people is to destroy the ring. They realize they can't hide it. They can't keep moving it around away from Sauron. He's going to track it down. The only option that they really have is to hope against hope and walk into Mordor and throw it into the volcano where it was first created. And if you were following this line of logic up to this point, if you've been following the story, it should be really, really clear that Frodo is the guy to do it. It should be really clear that Frodo is the guy that should do it. The ring came to him. It had chosen him, in a sense. Or some other will at work in the world had chosen him for this task, maybe. Even so, in the middle of the Council of Elrond, if you read the book, The Fellowship of the Ring, it's an incredible, incredible narrative. And if you pay attention to some of the details, there's some really beautiful insights that you can draw from it. For one thing, when they come to the moment where they're realizing we have to choose somebody to do this, there's this really silent pause. There's this long silent pause. Everyone is thinking. Everyone is pondering. Everyone is discerning. And there's this amazing moment when Frodo feels like everyone is looking at him, but when he looks around, nobody is. He's like, he must be thinking, man, they're just going to pick me. They know it's me. Like, everybody knows that I should do this. But when he looks around at all of the important people around him, this tiny little hobbit realizes that nobody is pressuring him. Nobody is looking to him to step up to this. And then there's this incredible detail that Tolkien, I think, intentionally includes. It says, the noon bell rang. The noon bell has profound implications for the Catholic reader. The noon bell marks the hour that Christ mounted the cross and began his agony, the 3 hours. The noon bell marks the hour that we prayed the Angelus. Yeah, thank you. Pray the Angelus. That's the noon bell that calls for the Angelus, right? That commemorates Mary's fiat, her yes, her earth-shattering yes to the angel Gabriel at the Annunciation. The noon bell is the hour of clarity. The noon bell is the hour that the sun is highest in the sky, when there are no shadows, when everything is bright, when the truth can be plainly seen. It is precisely then, after the noon bell rings, that Frodo glances around at all of those who are gathered, and Tolkien writes, but they were not turned to him. So they're not looking at him. And I think this is significant because Frodo is free. Frodo is free in this moment. And it seems to me that this is the sign of a very authentic vocation, when you find yourself free to choose. free to say yes, like Mary was free to say yes. Frodo was given the space that he needed to feel the immensity of the task that he was about to agree to. He recognized his place in it. He recognized how hard it was, but he also realized that he was free. There were no expectations placed upon him one way or the other. And that's the heart of a real vocation to the priesthood, the freedom to say yes. So then Tolkien proceeds to write these incredible words. Quote, "A great dread fell on Frodo, as if he was awaiting the pronouncement of some doom that he had long foreseen and vainly hoped might, after all, never be spoken." With these words, we get the sense that Frodo knew this moment was a long time coming. He realized that this everything was coming to a head, and this was the moment. Frodo now sensed the unsearchable vastness of providence at work. And he also knew, in a sense, that he'd already made a choice. He'd already made a lot of choices up to this point. And this was simply the culmination of all those little choices. This was the moment of truth. And I'd like to compare it to that intense, breathless moment when the angel came to Mary, hail, full of grace. She must have shuddered with dread, as if some pronouncement of doom, long foreseen, was about to be made. For the angel, in the scriptures, we read, responds with calm assurance, "Do not be afraid, Mary. Do not be afraid. You have found favor with God." And then we read Tolkien continue writing, "An overwhelming longing to rest and remain at peace by Bilbo's side in Rivendell filled all of Frodo's heart." And I think that this is a really natural response to a priestly call. Can't I just go home? Can't I just do the normal thing? Can't I just get married, have a wife, have kids? There's a longing for kind of a peace that we imagine, a longing for the familiar. And this is like the logical thing that a lot of people jump to when they think they hear a call to the priesthood. We continue in the narrative. "At last, with an effort, he spoke." At last, with an effort, he spoke. Notice Tolkien says that Frodo speaks with an effort. He speaks with an effort, as if he must overcome that longing for peace. He has to overcome that desire for rest. "With an effort, he spoke and wondered to hear his own words." He wondered to hear his own words, as if some other will was using his small voice. So in other words, Frodo can't believe that he's responding. He can't believe that he's saying yes. And yet, Tolkien says that he's exerting effort to do so. This is like the paradox of receiving a vocation, I think. How painfully true this is when we respond to God's gracious call. How brutally poignant saying yes to the Lord can seem. We must exert so much effort to say yes. We must resist our instinct to run away. And when we do finally say yes, we are astonished at the words that are coming out of our own mouths. This Saturday morning, I bet you that when Chris promises obedience and celibacy and to pray the Liturgy of the Hours faithfully, he will not believe the words that are coming out of his mouth. But he is going to be exerting effort to do that, and it will be God speaking through him. That's what's going on with Frodo here, I think. And then those fateful words actually fall from his lips. "I will take the ring," he finally says, "though I do not know the way." And there it is. It's spoken. The yes that holds all the doom and hope of Middle Earth. "I will take the ring, though I do not know the way." There's so much humility in that statement. Yes, but I do not know. I say yes, but I do not know. Thomas Merton has a great prayer. It starts off with, "Lord, I have no idea where I'm going," or "I have no idea what you're asking of me," basically. Like, basically, I don't know. I know you're calling me to do something great, but I don't know the way. Frodo is surrounded by the wise and the learned and the powerful, and yet he has the audacity to accept this mission. Frodo's response is profoundly Marian in character. It's just like Mary's yes. In fact, I propose that this moment is Frodo's fiat. "Behold, I am the ring bearer of the Lord. Be it done unto me according to your word." Like Mary, Frodo exerts himself so as to allow a higher will to use his small voice. In a sense, he's overshadowed by the power of the Most High. And yet, it's still Frodo's little voice that speaks. He's not forced, he's not dominated, he's not overwhelmed. Instead, Frodo is free to cooperate. Joseph Ratzinger, who would then go on to become Pope Benedict XVI, says that Christ dwells in the yes, and that becoming his servants means adopting Mary's attitude, through our yes, opening the door to his yes. It's very beautiful. So, like, we adopt Mary's attitude, and when we say yes, we open the door to God's yes. God is saying yes to us. He's saying yes to our love, our freedom, our peace, our joy, our rest, right? Frodo wants rest, but not in the way that God wants to give it to him. We want rest, but not always in the way that God wants to give it to us. We have to go on a journey first. We have to say yes to the cross first. So once Frodo utters his fiat, we then read that Elrond raised his eyes and looked at him, and Frodo felt his heart pierced by the sudden keenness of his glance. And I think this is very revealing as well. Only after Frodo freely says yes, offers to take the ring into Mordor, does anyone at the council actually look at him. And then meeting Elrond's bright eyes, it says that Frodo's heart is pierced. And we might draw the parallel to Simeon's words to Our Lady, "And a sword will pierce through your own soul also." And then Elrond speaks, and here are his words. "If I understand aright all that I have heard, I think that this task is appointed for you, Frodo, and if you do not find a way, no one will. But it is a heavy burden," he continues, "so heavy that none could lay it on another. I do not lay it on you, but if you take it freely, I will say that your choice is right. If I understand aright all that I have heard, I think that this task is appointed for you." That word right there, that is Elrond's confirmation of Frodo's yes. And I think it can be compared to the church's confirmation of a seminarian's yes. A seminarian hears a call from the Lord, and then he says, "Yes, Lord, I will go." But that's not just his decision. The church has to say, "Yes, that has been appointed for you. And if you enter into it freely, then your choice is right." And that's exactly what Elrond is saying to Frodo. It's basically the church saying, "Okay, yeah, Frodo, you can go on this quest. It's been appointed for you." But how precious freedom is in discerning one's vocation. Seminarians, they can often feel a lot of pressure to perform, a lot of pressure to continue on in their formation. You know, when we hear that a seminarian discerned out, I mean, it's almost like a bad word. But it's part of the process. Just going into seminary doesn't necessarily mean that someone is absolutely going to become a priest. It's part of the discernment process. It's part of saying yes to the Lord's call, no matter where that might lead. That's just really important to the life of a seminarian, to know that they have encouragement, that they have the support of the church, but that we don't pressure them, that we don't kind of act like if you don't do this, then you will somehow be less important in the church. It's not the case. It's not the case at all. Oops. So at this point, I'd like to turn to the topic of the quest itself, the mission of destroying the ring. It's been pointed out by a lot of writers that Frodo's quest is fundamentally priestly in character. And this is because Frodo's mission, at its core, is a supreme act of sacrifice. The word sacrifice is rooted in two Latin words. The first is sacer, meaning sacred, and the second, facere, which means to make. So the word sacrifice actually means to make sacred, to make holy. So priesthood and sacrifice belong together by their own very essence. We say that Jesus is the great high priest, that there is only one priesthood of Jesus Christ because he made that once-for-all sacrifice for us, for sinners. He made us sacred by that sacrifice, right? So there are different kinds of sacrifices, though. Some sacrifices involve handing something valuable over to somebody else. So in The Lord of the Rings, there's that funny story where Frodo is leaving for his journey, and he sacrifices his hobbit hole to his relatives that he doesn't get along so well, the Sackville Bagginses. And so he kind of sacrifices Bag End to them. That's kind of an example of a sacrifice in a certain sense, where the object offered, where the object sacrificed, is not destroyed. It's not immolated, as the word goes. It's still intact. So giving money to the church is another example of something like this. We give the money to the church, and of course the church doesn't burn the money. It uses the money. So the money is given as an object that is not consumed, that is not destroyed in itself. There is, however, another type of sacrifice that's associated specifically within the context of divine worship. And here I'm speaking of a sacrifice wherein the thing offered is totally and completely destroyed beyond any hope of retrieval. We call this a whole burnt offering or a holocaust. The sacrificial victim is immolated on the altar, perhaps by fire or some other kind of destruction. And nothing is left of the thing handed over. It's utterly destroyed. And in this sense, the quest to destroy the ring is a whole burnt offering. It is a sin offering. It's nothing of the ring is left unconsumed, right? It's completely melted in the fires of Mount Doom, beyond any hope of repair. Whole burnt offerings, otherwise referred to as holocaust, point to the fact that God rightfully has an absolute claim on everything. He is God, not us. And so we should be willing to sacrifice anything and everything in order to properly worship him and serve him. Within the context of the Lord of the Rings, nothing seems so valuable, so precious even, than the Ring of Power. And some people throughout the story start to wonder, well, can't we use it against Sauron? Can't we see it as a gift somehow? Like, isn't it precious to us? Shouldn't we keep it? Shouldn't we hold on to this? To sacrifice the ring, therefore, is a heroic act of self-renunciation. It is an act of faith. It's an act of worship. By destroying the ring bearer acts on behalf of all Middle Earth, as if to say the ring offers power and dominion. It offers immediate gratification. It offers overwhelming control. But in the end, this is all vanity. This is all nothing. And therefore, I do not need this. And therefore, I throw it away. I offer it in sacrifice. So throwing the ring away is a supreme act of worship, in the sense that it's a rejection of idolatry. It's turning towards God, who is worthy of all worship. He is the unconditional truth, worth giving everything up for. Everything must be submitted to God. Everything must be rendered unto him, sacrificed in faith to him. And maybe this is how we can understand Jesus' shocking words, right? He says, if your right hand causes you to sin, pluck it out. Throw it away. It's better for you to lose one of your members than to have your whole body thrown into Gehenna. So your eye is good. Your arm is good. It's a good thing. But if it's causing you to not worship God rightly, if it's causing you to not properly offer everything back to the Lord, then it's better to get rid of that, to sacrifice it. It's better to lose the ring than to remain enslaved by it. And here it's worth pointing out that Frodo literally had to sacrifice one of his members to finish the task. You might remember that Frodo loses a finger. So he actually loses a finger. He comes to the crack of doom. It's like the moment when he's about to throw the ring into the fires. And he decides, no, I'm actually going to keep it instead. I am not going to destroy the ring. And it's right at that moment that Gollum jumps out of nowhere. And he bites off Frodo's finger. And then proceeds to, in his joy, slip into the crack of doom and fall to his demise, and thereby destroying the ring inadvertently. So maybe we could rephrase Jesus' words. It's better to get your finger bitten off than to be cast into the fires of Mount Doom. And I think this moment is perhaps the finest example from the Lord of the Rings of what Tolkien calls eucatastrophe, which literally translates to good destruction. For Tolkien, a eucatastrophe is that sudden, miraculous moment where everything changes, that brings about an unlooked-for happy ending. So just at the moment of like total despair, total ruin, is precisely the moment that providence springs its like surprise. And it's a joyful surprise. It's a moment of unlooked for joy. And everything is made well again. It's a shocking invasion of beauty and goodness. It's the stuff that ends up bringing us to tears when we read Lord of the Rings or watch the movie. It's everything looks like it's so bad, but then it changes. You know, the eagles come in and save the day, that kind of thing. That is a Yu catastrophe. So all seems lost when Frodo claims the ring on Mount Doom. But the culmination of all the countless acts of mercy that he's shown to Gollum throughout the story come to fruition in this moment, in this Yu catastrophe. Gollum saves the day, fulfilling Gandalf's prediction long ago. He said, "My heart tells me that Gollum has some part to play for good or ill before this is over." And some readers, when they find out that Frodo chooses to keep the ring in the end, and only by providence does the ring actually get destroyed, might want to see everything as a failure. That they might want to blame Frodo that he gave up right at the last minute, in the final hour. But as Gandalf might say, don't be so eager to deal out death and judgment. One Tolkien scholar, Joseph Pierce, goes so far as to see this scene as proof of our constant dependence on God's mercy. So Frodo is not Jesus. You know, we've talked about this a lot, that Tolkien is not writing an allegory. His story is multi-layered. There's meaning. There's depth there. But Frodo is not Jesus. He is only a type or an image that points towards him, that suggests Christ-like elements. Therefore, Tolkien is able to include his failure to draw attention to the fact that only Christ's sacrifice is spotless, that only Jesus' offering of himself is perfect. Frodo finds himself dependent on providence, on mercy. You'll notice that nobody in the story ever blames Frodo. They never like heap shame on him. They celebrate. You know, the ring is destroyed. That's what matters. That's what matters. And he's never held accountable for this moment, because they knew how impossible this was, right? It's impossible for us to be perfect apart from God's grace. And perhaps this weakness and utter dependence on mercy is a good way for us to transition back to today's priesthood. This may come as a shock, or maybe not, but your parish priest, Father John David Ramsey, is not perfect. You know, Father Joe is not perfect. Yeah, Bishop Nestout is not perfect. These people that are our shepherds are not perfect. They are human instruments. They are earthen vessels with plenty of cracks to spare. And yet they are called to offer the holy sacrifice of the Mass, the perpetuation of the once-for-all sacrifice of Jesus on the cross, now risen from the grave. It is a lofty office, one that calls for an intimate union with our suffering Lord. The priest boldly speaks in persona Christi, "This is my body. This is my blood." He participates intimately in those words. He is also giving his body for the parish, for the church, for the world. This is my body given for you. You know, you can hear Father John David say those words, and you can believe it, that he's laying down his life too. But Christ is the one who's ultimately offering himself. That is what empowers our sacrifice. It's what empowers the priest's participation in everything. So he, the Venerable Archbishop Fulton Sheen, asked this really good question too. When asked about why there's so few vocations to the priesthood, he said, he asked the question, could it be that one reason for the lack of vocations is our failure to stress sacrifice? The young have a sense of victimhood that we underestimate. They want a mission. They want a challenge, he says. The young prefer the heroic, the sacrificial priest. They want the priest to mean it when he says, "This is my body, this is my blood." He is Christ in that moment. And it's beautiful. And what Fulton Sheen is getting at is simple. Priests aren't called to be bachelors. They're called to live like Christ and bear his presence into the world. Priests are not mere functionaries commissioned by the bishop to just go ahead and distribute the sacraments and just be, you know, an instrument in that way. They are called rather to live out the Christian life in a radical way that points to the fact that Jesus is the one baptizing, that Jesus is the one offering the Mass, that Jesus is the one forgiving, anointing, blessing. And at the same time, priests have to avoid the opposite extreme, right? They have to avoid that sense of a Messiah complex, that they are the ones that are saving everything. Or they have to avoid attracting a cult of personality that draws people to themselves rather than to the Lord. This kind of stuff is deadly to the church. And yet, sadly, it's so often the case that priests set out to fix the church. And thankfully, this is a futile effort. The church is in the hands of the Holy Spirit. Priests come and go, but the church and the faith that she guards is the pillar and foundation of truth. A priest's job, therefore, is to be faithful, to simply allow Jesus to be made present in the sacraments, to make the sacraments available, right? To call people to ongoing conversion, to care for the souls that have been entrusted to them, one by one, you know, on an individual basis. As Gandalf put it so well, it is not our part to master all the tides of the world, but to uproot the evil in the fields that we know, so that those who live after may have clean earth to till. That's the job of a priest, to uproot the evils in the fields that he knows, in his parish. You know, he is responsible for us. The parish priest, the pastor, is responsible for the souls that have been entrusted to him. So priests are supposed to reveal Jesus through their preaching, their teaching, and their shepherding. As St. Paul once said so beautifully, it's no longer I who live, but Christ who lives in me. And this goes for all Christians, of course, but most especially for the priest. It applies to him in a privileged way as an ordained minister, configured to Christ the head. So as ring bearer, Frodo becomes a Christ bearer. He reveals the person of Christ to anyone who reads the Lord of the Rings. We see Christ's priesthood modeled in the way that Frodo conducts himself as he prepares to make his sacrifice, as he goes up Mount Doom. So over the course of the entire Lord of the Rings trilogy, for that matter, Frodo's burden grows heavier and heavier. His participation in suffering grows and grows. And in a certain sense, he's no longer Frodo by the end. He's more and more the ring bearer. He is more and more the priest. His own identity as Frodo, son of Drogo, melts away. He's now the one whose entire life's breath is bound up in this vocation to offer the great sacrifice that will save all of Middle-earth, just as the priest's life should be centered on the celebration of the Eucharist. The priestly character is not an appendage to the priest's life. It's not a career. It's not just something tacked on. It's something that is integral. Frodo is forever a ring bearer. It is an ontological change, and it leaves its mark on him forever. Just like the priesthood is an ontological change. It changes the person forever. It's not something that's tacked onto his life. Frodo's climb up Mount Doom can also be compared to Christ's climb up Mount Calvary. So even some of the things that Frodo says and does mirrors the words and actions of Jesus during his passion. At one point, he turns to Sam and literally says, "I'm thirsty," echoing Jesus' words, "I thirst." When Sam tries encouraging him with the memories of the Shire, Frodo's response is filled with the abandonment of the suffering Messiah. No taste of food, no feel of water, no sound of wind, no memory of tree or grass or flower, no image of moon or star are left to me. I am naked in the dark, Sam, and there is no veil between me and the wheel of fire. I begin to see it even in my waking eyes, and all else fades. Frodo's next words could have just as easily been, my God, why have you forsaken me? Then, when Frodo's strength is all but spent, Sam realizes that his friend and master can't go on. So he literally has to pick Frodo up and carry him the rest of the way to the top of the mountain. This is a beautiful nod to Simon of Cyrene, right? Who helps Jesus carry his burden to the place of sacrifice. And I'd also like to mention here that Sam's incredible act of service gives us kind of an interesting window into the diaconal ministry. So as you know, the word deacon literally means servant. By their ordination, both transitional and permanent deacons are called to serve the altar, to help serve the priest who is offering the sacrifice. So too, Sam's role is to assist and serve Frodo, the priest, in his sacramental duties. And yet, Sam is not the one to offer the sacrifice, right? Just as the deacon isn't the one who actually says, this is my body, this is my blood. That's the priest's role, standing in the person of Christ. And in a similar way, Sam is just the humble gardener. He's just the humble servant who's helping Frodo accomplish his task. So to conclude our discussion on priesthood and sacrifice, I'll say this. Frodo assumed an impossible burden on behalf of all of Middle-earth, and the fruits of the victory changed everything. This is a Christ-like act, and therefore a priestly act. As St. Peter writes, quoting the prophet Isaiah, he himself bore our sins in his body on the tree, that we might die to sin and live to righteousness. By his wounds you have been healed. Today, Catholic priests continue to make present the victorious sacrifice of Christ over sin and death. As Fulton Sheen puts it, the priest's emptying of self for the people of the parish produces the spiritual prosperity of the parish. So too, Frodo empties himself for the people of Middle-earth. He gives to the last. It is, as St. Paul puts it, a kenosis, a self-emptying act of love on behalf of others. So participation in the sacrifice of Calvary in the Eucharist is not the only sacrifice that priests make. In the Latin Rite, priests are asked to make a promise of celibacy, which is a huge sacrifice. And surprisingly, Lord of the Rings can teach us a lot about the gift of celibacy as well. So celibacy, it's a commitment to the unmarried life. It should be pointed out that celibacy is way more than something that frees up a priest's calendar to fill up with lots of stuff. In sacrificing a wife and kids, the priest is not merely making more time for his parishioners. This would be to reduce celibacy to just like a utilitarian thing. It would just kind of make it into this practical motive, which it goes so much deeper than that. I'd also like to acknowledge that celibacy is deeply biblical. Most obviously, Jesus is celibate. And he recommends this way of life to those who can accept it. This is where the term celibacy for the sake of the kingdom or eunuchs for the sake of the kingdom comes into play. As the second person of the Trinity come in the flesh, Jesus models for us all the absolute deepest, most inviolable intimacy with the Father and the Holy Spirit. And this, as we discussed in our last lecture on marriage, is what the union of man and woman is ideally meant to pattern itself off of, the Trinitarian love. It points to God's life. It points to the union that we will all hopefully enjoy in heaven forever. So celibacy is not a rejection of the beauty of marriage. It's not built on a denial at all. Far from it, it's an embrace of the final end of marriage. It is a loud yes to the eschatological goal of real marriage, which is the general resurrection of the dead and the perfect union of a new heaven and a new earth. So celibacy is a claim that this life is not all there is. Celibacy is a sign that there's something else that we're waiting for, that we're pointing to. We are created to spend eternity with God, to enjoy him. And celibacy expresses that beautifully. It's a sign of hope. So Joseph Ratzinger once again says that the sign of celibacy expresses that we accept God as a reality into the most personal and innermost aspects of our lives. It is, he says, it's a dare to anyone who sees this witness to stake their life on him and accept him as a ground on which one can stand. Celibacy is for the church a sign, a pointer to the unshakable fact that God is trustworthy, that God knows best, that he's worthy of placing our entire weight on him. So how does Lord of the Rings depict celibacy, priestly celibacy at that? Well, there are many celibate individuals in the story, so Frodo and Bilbo immediately come to mind. They're both unmarried, but since we've already spent a lot of time talking about them, I'd like to discuss the celibacy of Gandalf the Wizard. So Gandalf, he reveals a central truth, I think, about the celibate heart. He loves generously. He loves generously. And it is not a particular love. So by particular love, I mean like the love for a single individual. So like a man loving a woman, a husband loving his wife, or a wife loving her husband. That is a particular love. But the love of a celibate is a more wide-ranging, open love to the church, right? It would be shockingly weird for Gandalf to have a girlfriend. He was not built to be married. He was created to be able to offer his love and service to Middle-earth in a different way, a radically sacrificial way. So too, the celibate priest loves the entire church as his spouse, and not merely a particular woman. In this way, he stands more perfectly in the person of Christ. He loves the church as his own body, and thus he lays his life down for her, right? The priest is offering himself for the church, for his spouse. And then the celibate heart is also fruitful. Maybe you've heard the term "father, what a waste." I don't know. It's a term that I don't like very much, but it basically implies that, like, oh well, I wish that guy got married. And my question is, like, who would dare say that Gandalf's life was wasted simply because he didn't have a wife and kids? He is constantly generating life and joy all around him. He is the wise guide and rock of support for countless people throughout the Lord of the Rings series. People rely on him as a fatherly, or at least a grandfatherly figure. And perhaps this helps us better understand what spiritual fatherhood is all about. People look to Gandalf for help. They look to him for comfort, for hope, for friendship, for discernment. He is one of the most influential, fruitful characters in the entire Middle-earth saga. He is known by many names to many cultures. He seems to be familiar with just about everybody that they come upon. Everybody in Tolkien's universe knows Gandalf by some name. He's incredibly fruitful. So this, I would argue, is really the heart of the gift of celibacy, to be able to love the many, to be available for them, spiritually and emotionally, to be with people, to walk with them, to smell like the sheep, like Pope Francis likes to say. Gandalf smells like the sheep. He doesn't look like much. He looks like an old man. But he's powerful. And I think that's the sign of celibacy. Is it doesn't look like much. To the world, it looks crazy. But it's powerful. He is able to be entirely focused on his mission at hand. And so, too, the priest is able to be focused in a way that maybe married people are not quite able to preach the gospel, to shepherd the people of God. They have a unique role to undertake, and celibacy is the gift that enables them to accomplish that. There's a beautiful image that Tolkien provides of Gandalf fearlessly leading the fellowship through the mines of Moria. And this speaks to the shepherding role of a priest, that they have to lead their people. So you remember from the Fellowship of the Ring, they're going through the mines of Moria, and Gandalf lights the end of his staff. And there's only this faint radiance that comes from the end of it. And yet that's their light. That's the light that the fellowship has to walk in the darkness by. And I think that this is a really beautiful image of the way that celibate priests are able to guide and shepherd their flock, humbly leading their parish through all those dense shadows, all of those really dangerous parts of life that are dark, all by just like this faint radiance, this faint light of faith. We instinctively desire this in our priests. You know, we want celibate priests, and I believe that if the church ever in the future discerns that it's time to, the Latin Rite anyways, to marry, to allow priests to marry, or allow married men to become priests, there will always be celibate priests. There will always be celibacy in the church because it is such a rich gift that God calls people to receive. Celibacy fits the priesthood. It fits it. And it fits Gandalf too. So when the wizard ultimately faces down the Balrog in those terrible dark mines, Gandalf announces that he is the servant of the secret fire. He says he's the servant of the secret fire, just as the celibate priest can boldly say in the face of the evils of our world, I am a servant of the Holy Spirit. You shall not pass, right? That's Gandalf's favorite line. That's the most famous thing that Gandalf says from the films. You shall not pass. And so too, the priest's ministry within the heart of the church is one that really scares evil. You know, John Vianney said that if there were a couple more priests, or the devil told Father John Vianney, rather, that if there were a few more priests like him in the world, his job would be a lot harder, that his kingdom would fall. So we need a couple good holy priests, and I believe that there are holy priests out there fighting on the front lines, shepherding their flocks, laying down their lives for people, providing the sacraments, allowing people to grow in conversion. And I'm just really grateful that God seems to be calling me to that life. And I'm really, really excited to see where it leads. Hopefully it's like Bilbo's adventure. It's going to go there and back again. Go to seminary, come back and serve, maybe even here at Mount Carmel one day. That'd be kind of fun. So I could go on and on about this beautiful sacrament, but our time is running short. And I'm losing my voice, I think. So this is our last lecture. This is the end of our journey. And in the words of Gandalf, I will say this. Here at last, dear friends, comes the end of our fellowship. Go in peace. I will not say do not weep, for not all tears are an evil. So just want to thank you again for joining me on this journey. It's been awesome. I'm kind of still blown away that I had an opportunity to even give this series. Father John David was very gracious and supportive, and I'm really happy for that. So thank you again for being here, and I pray that this series has brought glory to God and will help lead us all deeper into the life of the sacraments that Jesus has given us. So thank you so much.
Thank you.
It's over. It's done. All right.